What light does the Old Testament context throw on the word Redeemer, and what might it have meant to Job? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author, as we continue our series in the book of Job. My conversation partners are Dave Thomas, Dean of the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and Jen Ogden, Associate Pastor of the Walla Walla University Church. Let me dump that question on you again. How would Job have understood the word Goel from what we know of the Old Testament? Any of you want to try that one, or you want me to answer that?
Well, you asked the question, so it's not unfair to say you should answer it.
Well, I think it would have been vastly different than our understanding today in light of Jesus and the cross. I think he would have understood it in much more of a, I don't know, almost a punitive sense, an avenging sense. Someone who could restore fortune or rescue or that sort of thing, rather.
Or save him from his troubles.
Right, exactly. Could exonerate him from the circumstance.
Yeah. See, the Goel, and several places where it comes out in Scripture, it's a very violent term, actually, because its most violent one is the avenger of blood. And you see it in the cities of refuge, where the Goel is the one who comes to restore family honor. But you see it in its more gentle form in the book of Ruth, where Boaz is Goel,
kinsman redeemer,
comes to restore the family name and property. But the term redeemer, because of its implications of referring to Jesus, is one step beyond. And I like to refer to here the traditional interpretation and then the Old Testament contextual interpretation. I think Job would have heard that as would have said that, I know that my Goel, my near kinsman, lives, and that he will come and he will get the last word. See, I think that's, and of course there are a couple of other passages in Job where he cries out for an intercessor. If only somebody could get God and me to sit down together. Where is that guy? See, so that's the first passage. So we might talk about a universal application of this passage. It's seen as suggesting, caught a glimpse of the two important Christian truths.
But Alden, before you go into that, what does a Goel do?
The Goel actually restores family honor, name, and property. Those are the three things. So in the cities of refuge, you recover the family honor by killing the one who killed your family member. See, and you had to run to the city of refuge quickly. And God didn't see fit to change that at that time. But, so that, and he actually uses for Israel, I am your redeemer that led you out of the land of Egypt. So he applies it to himself. It's a very vivid term, someone who's going to put things right. So the one thing is, the more vivid one, family honor, is the cities of refuge. That's where you see that. But the other one, Boaz marries Ruth to preserve the name.
The family line, yeah.
The family line and the family property. See? And so it's a very vivid one. It's in that context that I think the first meaning Job would understand it.
Yeah,
he's in this tussle and he wants his Goel to come out. Now, once you know about the resurrection, it's terribly tempting to go back there and especially
read
when
that in
redeem and you read that into it. And I don't think that's wrong, just except when that keeps you from seeing the Old Testament context or when you are shocked when you read the Old Testament and a teacher suggests that. I mentioned earlier that one of my students, when I was explaining this to you, she says, the size of our preachable Bible gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
See, I don't know what she meant by that, though.
Because
I
was suggesting,
could argue it gets bigger and bigger.
Well, in a sense, but what is preachable in her perspective is that which has been true always, all times, and in all places. Probably about half of my students still believe that if God said it, it really should apply to all people, all times, and in all places.
So how was Nineveh not destroyed?
Yeah.
Well, there are all kinds of examples in the Bible that shows that's not a good way to think about things.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make any difference there. Okay. You know?
So you're saying that Job now is thinking of a intercessor who will come and fix what's broken. He will restore his fortunes.
He will confront God, and he will be his defender that will come in God's face, and he will have the last word.
That will mean that Job's suffering ends and his fortunes are restored.
That means that finally he would have made peace with God, and God would have understood because his Goel is there, And, oh, now we've got somebody that can bring the two of us together.
Okay.
Ta-da. Mm-hmm. And I think that's – and then that's a marvelous pattern for the larger one of what Jesus becomes. But the Redeemer, which means that there is a substitute of some kind, that's not included in the Goel language. Now, you have substitution all over the Old Testament. You
know, yeah, in the sacrificial system.
Yeah, you had to have an animal for every firstborn that was not a clean animal. It had to be sacrificed for every human being. You had to sacrifice some, which is goes back again to the story of Abraham, you know, where there's a firstborn is required, but then God provides the substitute. That's something which continues on. Now, let me ask a very practical question, one that comes out of my own experience. How can the study of the Bible itself help devout believers come to understand that not all truths that we hold dear were necessarily clear to earlier believers? See, I want students to be able to say, they didn't have to know everything that I know. But that's not an easy bridge to cross. I think if you take kids who may not have a strong relationship with the Lord and bring them to a religion class at the university level that does exegesis, which means interpreting a passage in time and place, when you point out that this has more limited in time and place, doesn't have universal application, their faith can come crashing down. And I think that's a reality that we need to take seriously. Even in my own teaching, I don't think that I have really come to grips with the students that are really angry at what I'm trying to do with them or for them. I read I happened to check one of my books, and a story that I had forgotten when many years ago I had done a workers' meeting at Camp Idahaven. And one of the pastors in the Northwest who had begun to ask questions, and this was a new thing for him, he didn't have anybody to talk to. He said, your workers' meetings there was the first time I had any evidence that I wasn't going out of my mind. But he said, when I went out in the breaks between presentations, the other pastors didn't want to come back in. So it was somehow a roadblock, and I don't know how easily one can build those bridges because we're all over the place.
But, you know, to me, it seems like a most obvious thing that the people who lived when there was less revelation from God would know less than we did. God has been acting in human history for thousands of years since the believers first appeared, and we have all that record, and therefore I would presume that our knowledge is more profound. I don't know how it could be otherwise.
Well, I think the implication then would also be that the instant I'm introduced to Christ or the idea of God and a divine source, that I understand it all. And that's quite a scary concept, that the instant there's an introduction, I have full knowledge and full ability to grapple with and understand. And then there's no sort of idea of transformation
or growth
or depth of understanding or experience. And so I think it leaves you at a very basic faith, which could easily crumble if there is a question posed that you can't answer or that you can't answer to any sort of satisfaction.
And this is where the testimony of Polycarp, which is a well-known story, is so profoundly moving. That here's a man who, you know, when they want him to forbear Christ and worship the emperor, he simply says, for 84 years, I have served him and he has never let me down, something to that effect. So I'm not going to do it now. That kind of testimony is far more gripping when made by an 84-year-old than made by a 14-year-old. See? And so it seems to me, why is Polycarp's faith and testimony more profound? It's because he has much more information and much more experience to speak from. I mean, I remember years ago going to a minister's conference where a man who happened to have been one of my teachers when I was at the seminary, he spoke, and he actually used to teach preaching, and he was not a very good preacher most of the time. He knew the technical elements of preaching, but he was not one who was invited all over the place to go speak. But he got up, and he basically told how, although he's retired now and that, you know, in some senses things are changing, he's not departing his faith, period. Mm-hmm. Very powerful moment. I remember when I first went to seminary, there was an old gentleman there, a Scottish gentleman, who preached a sermon at chapel on Enoch walked with God until he was not. That was his text. And to hear this man again in his 80s reflecting on that as a veteran of life's journeys, including life's journeys of faith, is a very powerful experience. Mm-hmm. So this idea of us suddenly knowing all, it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want somebody who has been on the way, not in the way, but on the way for a long time to have a far more robust and profound testimony than somebody who just arrived. Now, the person who just arrived might be much more excited
mm-hmm.
and effervescent and so very excited, but it doesn't have the depth.
It will be more brittle.
Yes,
yeah.
And it doesn't have the bite mm-hmm. that the testimony of, it's like asking newlyweds,
yeah.
Are you enjoying marriage versus somebody who's been married for 65 years? You get two very distant testimonies.
Yeah, I work with children a lot, and if you ask them about relationships, they'll be very basic, even humorous answers. Whereas if I ask my parents who've been married for 42 years about how to maintain a relationship over that period of time, I'll get completely different answers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And which one do I want to rely on, you know?
Yeah. So we should expect the same thing from the journey with mm-hmm. God and from the scripture, mm-hmm. that the people who had not seen. And I mean, look what Paul says. He says that all of those things happen as examples for us. Mm-hmm. So he's referring to the whole record of the past that is now available for us to contemplate. And we are actually more fortunate than the people who – and the amazing thing was they believed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are skeptics.
Yeah.
One other piece of logic that I think should help, although it may sound scary at first, is the conclusion that I think is relatively easy to sell based on New Testament statements, that Jesus is the clearest revelation of God.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But if you say that and think about it for a bit, that means that there are other revelations of God that are not as clear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why would God give some revelations that are not as clear? Obviously, because that was the only way that they could understand.
That's correct.
Yes.
So you hold on to Jesus, the clearest revelation of God, and then you place everything else en route to that direction. And I think that would make very important. So
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let me conclude with a quick quotation here from C.S. Lewis in his Grief Observed. He says, "My idea of God is not a divine idea. It has to be shattered time after time. He shatters it himself. He is the great iconoclast. Could we not almost say that this shattering is one of the marks of his presence? The incarnation is the supreme example. It leaves all previous ideas of the Messiah in ruins."
Good quote.
Yeah.
Our time is up. Next week we talk about the character of Job. And my conversation partners are again Jen and Dave. My thanks to Jared Miller, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.